Since the 1800s, Hickok & Boardman Insurance Group has been providing quality service and peace of mind to our clients. With our offices in Burlington, Stowe, and St. Albans, and our Dennis Ricker & Brown offices in Montpelier and Lynnonville, we are here when you need us.
And now WDEV-FM and AM presents our two-hour public affairs program, Open Mic with Mike Smith. Important topics, topical guests, and your phone calls. And now here's the host of Open Mic, Mike Smith.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining us this morning. Very interesting program today as we focus on the pipeline expansion of Vermont Gas. Joining us today will be guest Chris Recchia, Commissioner of the Public Service Department, and Don Rendell, who's the President and CEO of Vermont Gas. And, of course, we'll add to some discussion on national politics with former Ohio Congressman Bob Ney. He'll join us to talk about national politics, campaigns, and other issues in the news. But first up, joining me today in our WDEV studios is Chris Recchia, Commissioner of the Public Service Department. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Mike.
The department has two relevant cases before it regarding Vermont Gas. One is the pipeline extension and the other is the rate case. So let's start first with the pipeline expansion. What is the department's position on the pipeline expansion and why?
Great. Yeah. So I appreciate your distinction of those two, because that's been one of the tensions throughout this whole thing, and I'll get into that in a little bit. But the department has been supportive of the pipeline, and there are a variety of reasons for that. One is we do a cost-benefit analysis when the project is first proposed, and we found that the benefits to Vermonters would be in the tens of millions of dollars over the life of the project. And it provides a choice for consumers who are currently either on oil or propane and have no other options. And the volatility in the pricing of that is pretty significant and can affect people on fixed incomes. So we felt that the pipeline provided a third option of natural gas. It is also cleaner. We found that there were carbon benefits from doing that, that advanced our goals for energy and climate goals. And as I said, it just in terms of the economics of it, it made sense in terms of the benefits, net benefits to Vermonters.
You signed an MOU with Vermont Gas that had several provisions. The first provision, if you could just address that, would be anything in excess over, I think it's $135
million. $134, correct.
$134, yep. Would be borne by the shareholders, not the ratepayers. And two, what surprised many and has been in the news is the cost of protests can be passed on to the ratepayer. Let's talk about the cost of the protest first and then come back to the cap. I guess I'll call it the cap, the $134
sure.
million dollar cap. Why is there a provision where the cost of protests can be passed on to the ratepayers?
Sure. Well, in most types of utility cases where things are beyond the control of the company, those are usually passed on to ratepayers, provided they were, they were incurred not as a result of company action. And I want to clarify on the protests. It's not all protests. It's protests that would interfere with the construction of the pipeline. So those, by definition, are going to be unlawful protests. I'm very supportive of protests. We have accommodated them at my office,
at
the
home?
State House, and at my home. I will admit that one wasn't particularly pleasant. But I fully, appreciate the right of people to protest and to disagree. And, for the most part, we've done that in a professional and respectful manner on both sides. But where it interferes with the construction of the pipeline, it will cost ratepayers money. And I wanted to be absolutely transparent about that in the MOU, that those costs would not be borne by the shareholders of the company but by ratepayers, and to make people on notice that if they were trying to punish the company, they were going to have an inverse result. So I felt that that was important to clarify.
Let's talk about the $134 million mm-hmm. cap. How was that arrived at, and what happens if the company exceeds that cap?
Right. So when this project was first proposed, it was estimated to cost about $86 million. The next within months after the CPG, the Certificate of Public Good, was issued, it went up to $121 million and then $154 million. When it was at $154 million, I already could see that there were going to be costs that should not be borne by ratepayers. And when I said before that there's been a tension between, you know, the project costs and ratepayers, people were assuming that all 100% of the costs of this project would be passed on to ratepayers, and I could see that wasn't the case. I was making the point that there would be a rate case, which we're in now, and I'm sure we'll talk about, that would decipher what amount should be actually borne by the company. In the meantime, just based on kind of estimate, I said, all right, we need to put a cap on this project because I'm not even confident that the 154 was accurate, and that was probably wise because they're now up to 165. So the 134 was intended to be a maximum that could be recovered and put into rates. And the company is now at $165.5 million. So that's $31 million that the company shareholders will need to absorb. The cap is a firm cap with the exception of the exceptions that we talked about, the protests, and then also if there was an excessive delay in right-of-way acquisition. Those things would be above the cap, but so far relatively little has been above the cap. So I would expect them to be no more than $134 million.
One of the questions that I had, isn't it all ratepayer funded? I mean, that's where they get the cash that comes into the company. Where the shareholders benefit is when there's excess over expenses. They get they get dividends, they get higher stock prices, those sort of things. So isn't it – I'm just curious. How do you make a difference between shareholder and ratepayer?
Mm-hmm. So the way a utility works is by virtue of the fact that they're given essentially a monopoly over either geographic area or a particular product. And in the case of electricity, they have both. There's only one electricity company for each consumer, and there's a geographic area that company serves. In the case of Vermont Gas, there is competition on the fuel, and we mentioned oil and propane, but there's not a competition in terms of geographic area. They're given a particular area to serve. So in exchange for that, what happens is that the company is supposed to make investments in their capital for projects. They're supposed to do that from shareholder money and from investor money, and then they get a return on equity on that amount. And it's a reduced return from what they would get if they were a private investor investing in something, you know, that they felt would be a good return on the investment. And it's less because there's less risk for them. But nonetheless, it's pretty substantial. It's we've recommended 9%. The company was asking for 9.7%. That's a pretty typical return on equity. The difference in this case is that there was established a fund back in 2011 that is called the System Expansion and Reliability Fund, or SERF. I'll use SERF for short, where because the price of gas was dropping pretty precipitously, it was decided by the Public Service Board that they would return some of that to ratepayers but save some of it for system expansion. So they created this fund in which ratepayer dollars went in order to help support the fund going forward. It's a little unusual. And as I say, typically a utility will make the investment themselves and then get the return on the investment over time. in this case, most of the money is being done that way, but there's about $25 million now in the SURF that could be used for reducing the cost of the project.
We're speaking with Chris Recchia, Commissioner of the Public Service Department. If you wish to join our conversation, the number is 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. Let's go back to the project, the expansion project. AARP says that this construction should not be borne by the ratepayers at all because they believe their clientele, which are seniors, are price sensitive, and they believe this will have an impact on seniors who don't benefit from the pipeline.
Right. So again, I think they're ignoring the consumer options and the choice and the need for there to be a more cost effective of choice for consumers. And, you know, obviously a lot of those are seniors and on fixed income as well. And we believe that the choice is valuable and that the gas prices have been lower compared to oil and propane over time. So in terms of price being borne by ratepayers, this again, you know, they've opposed the project from the beginning, but they've, I think, been conflating the issue of the project construction versus what actually goes into rates. And I'm sure we'll get into this, but just last Monday we recommended that only $112 million get put into rates this year as opposed to the $134 that the company had requested and is the cap.
This pipeline has generated, I guess you would say, much controversy. Is the word, with cost overruns, protests. Is it worth it?
Well, now you're asking me hindsight. This has been a painful project, no doubt about it, for us and for citizens wishing to participate in it, for people concerned about climate change, for people concerned about investment in fossil fuel infrastructure. But again, we come back to what are the net benefits to Vermonters, and we saw this still, and even at $165 million, you know, we still think there are tens of millions of dollars of net benefit for Vermonters. And again, the ability to use a cleaner fuel, a cheaper fuel, a more reliable and stable cost fuel makes sense. And so, yeah, I think it is worth it. And, you know, we've got a major community in the Middlebury area with companies like Agrimart and things like that that could make very good use of this in terms of saving money and investing in other employees and making their product more competitive.
The protesters will contend that the pipeline fosters more fossil fuel because it only – and it increases our carbon footprint because it uses fossil fuel. Mm-hmm. Gas is a fossil fuel. They also contend that it encourages fracking. Are they right?
Well, right now, an important thing to know is that really all your oil and gas is coming from mostly fracked sources. So when the fracking argument is not unique to gas. It is responsible for the lower oil prices we've seen recently. I think in terms of the investment in infrastructure and the concern that that's going to commit us to using gas indefinitely is incorrect. And you'll appreciate this analogy because I know your past experience. No more than telephone poles and wires and telephone wires have committed us to a wired technology. Everybody, you know, is going to wireless, right, and cell phones. That did not stop people. You know, the fact that we had infrastructure investment in poles and wires did not stop people from going to wireless. Similarly, if, you know, this infrastructure goes in and it's used for 50 years and people find that that there are alternatives that are cheaper, more cost-effective, and more environmentally friendly, they will switch. And I also have a hope that we will be able to put more renewable natural gas into the system from methane digesters and other things that will increase the percentage of renewables over time that are actually in the pipeline as well.
We're speaking with Chris Recchia, who's the commissioner of the Public Service Department. If you wish to join our conversation, the number is 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. What we're talking about is Vermont Gas Pipeline expansion. And also, in a minute, we'll get to the Vermont Gas rate case. I want to go to the phone lines. Rama in Williamstown. Rama, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning. Hey, a comment and then a question. And the comment being, I am very, I actually believe the PSB made a horrible, horrible mistake when they said that this project was for the public good and not for private commercial interest. I have yet to hear anything that satisfies the criteria of public good. But the question is, goes back to the comment Mr. Recchia made about the geographic monopoly that this Vermont Gas will enjoy with this pipeline. Are you saying that no other company within a certain geographic region of that pipeline can sell natural gas to customers?
Thanks, Rama, for
Thanks,
your phone
Rama.
Call.
Yes, I am. The way a utility works is that is the compromise in exchange for essentially a monopoly in a particular area. We regulate them like they would be regulated, or like they would in place of competition. So we look at their rates, we look at their costs, we continually push those down, and the company, you don't want multiple people building, you know, parallel pipelines to the same place. So you try and design systems, and the same is true for your electric systems, to make sure that, you know, the company that is there and has the infrastructure is providing quality service at an efficient, cost-effective price.
And that's not unusual, as you point out. Green Mountain Power is basically a monopoly for the state utility.
Yes, and they cover 80% of the state, and we have a handful of other utilities. That's right.
Let's turn to the rate case that's before you now. Vermont Gas has asked for a decrease in rates, and I think it was, I don't remember,
3.3%.
Mm-hmm. The department's position is that the decrease should be more. Mm-hmm. Why?
Well, this is going to be a little complicated, so bear with me. So when we looked at the 3.3%, we realized that was for their firm customers. But when we look at the overall rate decrease for all their customers, it was actually 2.43, so a little less, 2.43% reduction. We're proposing a 5.68% reduction also for all their customers, so an apples-to-apples comparison. But we do it in a different way. As you know, they asked for the full cap amount, $134 million, to be put into rates. They also wanted to use $13.9 million of the SURF that I talked about earlier to reduce that. Without the SURF, it would have actually been a 10.31% increase. So I just want to make sure we're comparing apples to apples as we talk here. Without any use of the SURF, we would be at a minus 1.03%. So that's like an 11% decrease, comparing apples to apples. Sorry to keep using that analogy. But then we do recommend using about $5 million of the SURF, because that's what customers contribute each year. We figured let's start using that and returning that to ratepayers, and that's what brings us down to the 5.68% reduction.
And what happens now in terms of the process? The Vermont Gas wants this amount of a reduction, and I can't believe we're talking a reduction because SURF is used in this. Is that correct?
We are in the case of Vermont Gas's proposal. We're not in the case of our proposal. We could do a reduction of 1.03% without use of SURF.
You also disallowed some money.
Oh yeah, that's an important point. So thank you, Mike. So as I mentioned, Vermont Gas was looking for the $134 million. When we looked at this, we felt that that more should be disallowed as being imprudent expenditures, and I'll explain what that is in a second. But that brought us down to 112.5. So we're actually looking at another $28 million reduction from what they had proposed. So I mentioned that the pipeline is $165 million right now. We actually look for documentation of expenditures and value and we've gone through all their contracts and all their expenses, and we found good documentation for only $145 million of that. So right off the bat, we're starting with $145 million number, not the $165. And then we found about $35.5 million of expenses that we felt were imprudently incurred, things like starting work with no contract, the fact that they had to replace contractors along the way. There's inefficiencies there that should not be borne by the ratepayers but by the company due to their decisions. So when you take the 135.5 off of the 145, you get the 112 that we're recommending go into rates.
So how is this all resolved?
So this is the second step in the process of a long process. Vermont Gas did their proposal. We just last Monday did our counterproposal. They'll get a chance to respond to that. They and other parties, including AARP, will be able to weigh in and question under oath and before the board what the basis of our testimony is and what the basis of Vermont Gas testimony is. Ultimately, the board will decide probably toward the end of the year or the beginning of next year what should go into rates.
One of the things, going back to the pipeline, is it on the right timeline, I guess, because revenues and expenditures are tied to a specific timeline.
Yes.
With the pipeline. Is it on time?
So Vermont Gas will tell you that they're trying very hard to get this in before the end of the year and by in November. Their rate year starts October 1st. So if they were successful in getting this to be in place in November, then most of the year this would be in service, and you would and therefore most of the 112.5 million that we talked about would be go into rates in that year. We don't believe they're going to be done in November. We think more likely that the system will be operational and what we call used and useful in May of 2017. So that's really half the rate year. What it means is the 112.5 million that we're recommending will be prorated for those 6 months and only go into effect. It will go into effect October 1st, but it will be essentially half of that amount that will be spread out over that rate year. So you're right that there's a difference between the rate year and when the project's completed. And what happens is the project does not get to start recovering any costs until it is actually operational. And when we make our best guess as to when that will be and prorate that over the whole rate year. But in the event that we're wrong and it gets in place sooner or later, that will be adjusted in the following year. So we'll get close, maybe not exactly right, but we'll be closer, we think, by giving them 6 months of operation versus their belief that they get 11 or 12 months.
But doesn't that affect rate calculations?
It certainly does. Yes, absolutely. It's a complicated equation. And you always get to true it up the following year, but you want to get pretty close the first time.
One of the things that I noticed in the news lately is that a lawyer is contending that the whole approval process of the gas pipeline is flawed because it was supposed to go through the Act 250 process rather than the Public Service Board. What is the department's position on that?
Absolutely not. This has been this was filed in 2011, I think, was only. So we've been doing this for 5 years, and that attorney has been present at every single proceeding through that process, and the time to raise that would have been in the very beginning. But we're very confident that this is appropriately this is a transmission line which under FERC is regulated by the State Public Utility Commission, in this case the Public Service Board. It does not go through Act 250, and the the actual distribution components of this are exempt from Act 250 because they're underground. There's an exemption for that, for linear projects underground in Act 250. So we're very confident we're in the right jurisdiction. You know, we've been putting this work in for 5 years. That is a Hail Mary pass in the wrong, like downfield in the wrong direction is how I look at that.
The Burlington Free Press did an editorial recently where it said we need to put public back in the public service department. How do you respond?
Well, I was pretty upset about that, naturally. I looked at that and thought, first of all, they misquoted me. They said that I was trying to stop protests, and it was a complete – they cut off, truncated the sentence. The complete sentence, which I will be happy to repeat now, was trying to stop protests that interfered with construction of the project. And to distinguish those, I very much support people's right to protest and their First Amendment rights to disagree with things. But they need to do so in a peaceful, non-obstructive way. The types of protests I was talking about were the unlawful ones where you were chaining yourself to piping, you're trespassing on other people's property. And I felt that the Free Press knew that and unfairly characterized that in order to promote their narrative. We always have the public in mind, and the public includes the protesters, obviously, but it includes the landowners, it includes the construction workers, it includes their safety, it includes the customers that are served by this pipeline. And, you know, we look at all of those and determine what's in the public interest, and we felt that this project is in the public interest and that protests are fine. You know, as I said, I've accommodated them in various places, including my office and, as you pointed out, at my house. And, you know, the appropriate place is on public in public squares and things like that. And, you know, we will always reach out to protesters and try and understand their views and respond to them, you know, both professionally and respectfully. But they can't interfere with the pipeline construction because that will cost, as we talked about before, ratepayers money, not the company money.
I've got a few questions that don't relate to Vermont Gas, why I've got you here. One is the siting of industrial and solar wind projects and solar projects. What's the department's position on local participation?
Right. So, you know, this has been a frustration of people across the state for several years. So 2 years ago, I actually started sponsoring for my own budget planning for communities and regions that wished to, you know, be part of the solution. I firmly believe Vermonters want to be part of this energy solution and generally agree with our direction. They do need a say and a role in how this goes. And so things have changed in utility world. You know, it used to be we'd build one or two big power plants like Vermont Yankee or, you know, a big, you know, plant somewhere. And it was important that the state interest trump a local interest in that case because very few times would a local community be wishing to engage in that. Now, with the distributed generation of solar and wind, it's starting to look more like land use planning than it is like utility siting. And so I took the initiative and started sponsoring as a pilot project three regional planning commissions to do a deep dive into energy planning, not just where they didn't want things to occur, but where they did want things to occur. That was extremely successful, and we found that there was plenty of places to put these projects in a way that the community felt good about it and that still provided the energy that we needed. So this year I'm doing another four, and next year I did them in January, started those, and then in July started the remaining three. So all 11 regional planning commissions will get a chance to do this. We also passed the legislature passed Act 147 last year, which kind of codified this work but also brought it down to the municipal level so that towns can also participate in their planning. I think planning and advanced planning is where that work needs to be done, where towns need to first weigh in so that developers know where they should be going and where they shouldn't be. And we also get that benefit of good work done to say, look, we want to be part of our energy planning and energy future, but we want these projects here and not there. And we're going to try and respect that if they do, if they're willing to do the work.
This is an interesting time of year for secretaries and commissioners.
Oh, yes.
There's a change of administration. As you sort of look back, what's your proudest moment as commissioner?
I have several, but I think the first thing that comes to mind is the closing of Vermont Yankee and the economic benefit and negotiated settlement that we reached with Entergy on that project. It was very constructive for Vermont. Entergy will say the plant was going to close anyway because of economics. Well, we were able to make that a constructive thing for the Windham County area as well as for the Vermont as a whole. But also then I would say, you know, the success of the distributed distributed generation work that we've done in solar and wind and hydro has been tremendous. I mean, we have citizens participating in their energy future in a way that makes it real for them and they understand and get benefits from being able to actually have their own energy sources, and they help their community by doing that. So, you know, those two come to mind. There's so many others, though. The Comprehensive Energy Plan rewrite in 2016 that'll get us through the next 5 years actually put some meat on the bones of that 90% renewable goal. So there's a ton of stuff. This has been an exciting, of course, difficult job, but it's been very rewarding, and very proud of Vermont for how they go about taking responsibility for their energy future.
And some will contend it's one of the most difficult jobs in state government.
Well, no one told me that when I took it, unfortunately, but I would tend to agree with that. I mean, I think that my background was primarily in natural resources. I worked in the agency natural resources for a long time. I've also been in the private sector and nonprofit sectors. So what I see about this job is it's one that affects citizens every single day, and probably is one of the most, the one that affects people in their daily lives the most. And I'm very proud of being able to keep, you know, the other piece I would say is, you know, we've kept rates very low and stable throughout this four year period that I've been commissioner. We've been below the rate of inflation. We've reduced rates more times than we've raised them. And when we've raised them, it's always been lower than the rate of inflation. So I think that gives people stability and the ability to plan for their economic future. It's a pleasure to have been able to provide that service.
Thank you, Chris Recchia.
Thank you very much, Mike.
That is Chris Recchia, Commissioner of the Public Service Department. Coming up, we have a few minutes to sort of open up the phone lines, and I really am dying to get to this issue with you all. It's Colin Kaepernick's decision not to stand during the national anthem. Want your opinions. And in the second hour, we'll check in with Bob Ney at Talk Media News, and we'll also speak with Don Rendell, the president and CEO of Vermont Gas. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. I've been itching to get to this controversy. To get your opinions, so give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. And the controversy happened over the weekend with San Francisco 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick remained seated while the national anthem played. It was prior to the game with the Green Bay Packers, and he sat down as a protest. What he said was he didn't want to show pride in a country that oppresses people of color. And here's his quote. Kaepernick said, "To me, this is bigger than football, and it would be selfish on my part to look the other way. There are bodies in the street, and people are getting paid leave and getting away with murder." Which leads me to two questions based upon what Colin Kaepernick said, and I'd be very interested in your opinions. The first question, should he protest by sitting down during the national anthem, or should he find another way to bring light to his issues? And I don't want to dismiss the issues as Colin Kaepernick sees them. But the question is this the appropriate venue to make his protest? The second question, and it's a very, I guess, emotional question to many people, depending on which side of the question you're on. Are police getting away with murder? Obviously, the San Francisco Police Department Union is demanding an apology. So give me a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Be very interested in your opinion on these two questions. Should Colin Kaepernick protest by sitting down during the national anthem, or should he find another method to bring light to his issues? And number two, are police getting away with murder? Again, the number is 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. Let's go to the phone lines, and let's go to Paul in Moncton. Paul, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike. The short answer to the first question is yes, he should, if that's what he believes is in his best interest, in the interest of what he believes is going to help the cause. But with that said, the reality is, this has all been about him. There is no discussion about police brutality and or the problems with police shootings in general. It's all been about Colin Kaepernick. And from what I've been hearing, he's a bit of a prima donna and not the most friendly person in the clubhouse. So I think he's put himself on the line, and I think he's done so for a reason other than what he states. So I do support his right to do that. But ultimately, because it is about him, he's not really getting the conversation going that he claims. And then finally, where does it end? At some point, the NFL is going to have to stand up and or the individual teams, because the next protest could be about someone not liking the person singing the national anthem. It could be about whatever group of people happens to be carrying the flag in. I mean, it can go on and on and on. And they're a private organization, so the NFL itself may step up and say, we're just going to stop this, or we're not going to play the national anthem anymore.
Thanks, Paul, for your phone call. What we're talking about this morning is San Francisco 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick. I've been itching to get to this question, to get your opinions, your comments on this issue, which is his protest about a country that opposes people of color, and how he's decided to protest is not stand during the national anthem during football games. Should he protest by sitting during the national anthem, or should he find another method to bring light to these issues? And he also says there are bodies in the street and people are getting paid leave and getting away with murder. So the second question I have, are police getting away with murder? Give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Let's go to Mark in Ferrisburg. Mark, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Good morning. I do believe police are getting away with murder, but there's like a few bad apples. Police and state troopers on the whole, I think, are doing a very good job, but there's probably 10 or 15% that should be prosecuted, just like you were. Or I would.
Mm-hmm. What about the other question that I asked Mark? Should he be using the national anthem as his vehicle for protest?
He should. I'm rather embarrassed to be an American at this point. Mm-hmm. Just there are so many things wrong in this country and our foreign policy. It's not a good time.
Mark, thank you for your phone calls. What we're talking is about San Francisco 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick, who is protesting the oppression of people of color by not standing for the national anthem. What's your opinion? Give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. Lot of interesting responses from coaches and other people in the NFL. former players, current players. It's all over the map in terms of one. I think what we can sort of group together is that everyone agrees that you have a right to protest in this country, and where the disagreement has come is on the vehicle that Colin Kaepernick is using in order to voice his protests. For example, it is his former coach, Jim Harbaugh, who of the 49ers, now Michigan Wolverine football coach, who said, "It is his method of action that I take exception to." His brother, who is the coach of the Baltimore Ravens, John Harbaugh, said that, "I may not agree with what you say, but I'll defend it until death. You're right to say it," John Harbaugh said. "That's a principle of our country is founded on, and I don't think you can't deny someone the right to speak out or mock or make fun or belittle anybody else's opinion." It was interesting, Cleveland Browns Hall of Fame running back Jim Brown voiced an opinion which said he did not necessarily agree with the method, but that he stands with Kaepernick's readiness to fight for what he believes in. New Orleans Saints quarterback Drew Brees had a different opinion. He voiced his displeasure with the protests and said he believes that standing for the anthem is a way for players to give thanks to our military members who have sacrificed so much for the flag throughout history. It is, and even politicians, presidential politicians, have weighed in. Donald Trump called Kaepernick's protest as a terrible thing. Maybe he should find a country that works better for him. The other thing, Seahawks cornerback Richard Sherman said, "There is some depth and some truth into what he is doing," Sherman says. "I think he could have picked a better platform and a better way to do it, but every single day they say athletes are so robotic and do everything by the book. And then when somebody takes a stand like that, he gets his head chopped off." Appreciate your opinions on Colin Kaepernick. Give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Should he be using the national anthem, sitting at the national anthem, as a vehicle for his protest? When we come back, we'll take more of your phone calls. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. We're talking about Colin Kaepernick, the San Francisco 49ers quarterback who over the weekend refused to stand for the national anthem because he didn't want to show pride in a country that oppresses people of color. Kaepernick said, "To me, this is bigger than football, and it would be selfish on my part to look the other way. There are bodies in the street and people are on paid leave and getting away with murder." So the question today, and I'll take this right up to the top of the hour. I got a bunch of stuff in the stack here, but let's take this up to the top of the hour. The question that I have today is, should he protest by using the national anthem, or should he find another vehicle? And two, are police getting away with murder nowadays? Give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Couple of things that seem to be pertinent to this case. One is, when does this stop? When will Colin Kaepernick be satisfied that this country isn't oppressing people of color? He says he's going to continue until he sees improvement. Well, what constitutes improvement? Certainly, we've improved since 1968 when the Olympic protests were. But there's no doubt that we have a lot further to go in our race relations here in the United States. But what marks, and he hasn't said this, what marks improvement? What are the criteria for him not sitting during the national anthem? And is it criteria that will ever be met in his NFL career? I hope it will be met, but will it be met in his NFL career? The second issue is he's a well-known NFL quarterback. He could get attention any way that he wants. He could hold a press conference. He could go on ESPN anytime that he wants. Is this the proper vehicle for gaining that attention? Certainly he's got the attention that he wants, but is this the proper vehicle? I would agree with most people that are out there that this probably isn't the proper vehicle. The national anthem is, as much as we think about it in terms of celebrating our whole country, it does have a focus on military members. After all, it was crafted during a battle, a Revolutionary War battle, or 1812. I can't remember which battle it was, but it was 1812, I think. Battle. So it does have these military roots. So there are sensitivities to this that Colin Kaepernick should appreciate. The second thing is his teammates. Going to a press conference and doing and speaking up against what he believes is the oppression of people of color is one thing. But not standing for the national anthem has a whole different meaning for his teammates. And the spotlight that goes on his teammates. It is a distraction to some extent for his team. And taking nothing away from the cause. Coaches, owners, players can't be happy with this. Isn't there another way to do the same thing that Colin Kaepernick is doing by refusing to stand for the national anthem? Isn't there another way? The other thing is, and a caller brought this up, are there wrongful deaths by police officers in the United States? Yes, there is. Is it prevalent? Do police officers go out to try to kill people? I can't buy that. And as the caller brought up, there are some police officers who have unjustly killed people, and they should be prosecuted. But I don't believe this is sort of the prevalent feeling of police throughout the country. So the question is today, and we got a minute for a few more phone calls, is should Colin Kaepernick be protesting by sitting during the national anthem, or should he find another method to bring light to this issue? Let's go to Dee in Duxbury. Dee, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Hi. I really agree with you. This is all about him. I didn't even know who he is. I didn't even watch football. But now I know. I've heard his name. And you know, come on. I mean, we do have racism. As you probably know, we adopt our children, so we have brown children. And, you know, I mean, I know about that. I know about the racism thing. But, oh, my goodness, this sounds so much like him. And you're right, police officers have broken the law. Back in the riots in Baltimore, when the police backed off, things got crazy. What if police just decided, we don't want to go into that neighborhood, we don't want to go there to do our jobs, protect people, keep people safe? I mean, I think he ought to just quit football and do something else.
D, if you're into football, that may happen anyway because he's been on the cut list of the 49ers. But I thank you for your call. Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you very much. Let's go to Eric in Johnson. Eric, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Hey, Mike. Good morning. I think that he's I love America and football, and I think he's correct. I wasn't aware of the issues with the national anthem with its references to slavery, and I think his bringing this to everyone's attention is working, and I appreciate it.
Eric, well, go ahead, Eric. I got about 30 seconds left
here.
Okay,
I think, he's done everyone a good service. I appreciate it.
Hey, Eric, thank you for your phone call. Coming up, we're going to be talking with Bob Ney of Talk Media News. And I want to really zero in on a couple of things, maybe even this Colin Kaepernick issue as well. But what really want to zero in is on Donald Trump's immigration policy and where the heck he is now. And then Don Rendell, who's the president and CEO of Vermont Gas. And we're going to continue our conversation about the Vermont Gas Pipeline expansion and their rate case. This is Open Mic, and you are listening to locally owned and operated WDEV News Radio on the Friendly Pioneer, celebrating its 85th year anniversary this year. Celebrating the future. Can you believe it? 85 years. WDEV News Radio. WDEV AM 550, broadcasting from Waterbury and Montpelier, 96.1 FM from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barrie, and serving the kingdom at 101.9 FM from Island Pond. Of course, we're streaming worldwide at WDEVradio.com. Coming up, Bob Ney and Don Rendell. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. It's my pleasure to welcome to Open Mic Bob Ney from Talk Media News. Bob, good morning.
Good morning, Mike. How are you?
I am fantastic. It's getting to be fall, and I can't believe summer is almost over here.
Well, I want the election to be over with, so.
Let's get this. This story makes me squeamish, and but let's get it out of the way. Former Congressman Anthony Weiner has again been caught sexting with some pictures with his son in the pictures. His wife obviously is a very important person in the Hillary Clinton campaign. Does this make any difference other than the fact that something's wrong with Anthony Weiner?
Yes, it does. And, you know, Huma Aberdeen has asked for privacy in this. Well, good luck, Huma. If you want privacy, resign from Hillary Clinton's campaign. Now, I say that because, disclaimer here, Corey Lewandowski ran my campaigns in 1998 and 2000. And he, of course, became the famous campaign manager of Donald Trump, who was fired. He also was accused of dragging Michelle Fields down to the ground, which we know now by video didn't happen, but there is a question. Did he bump her, grab her? Okay, so I'm just saying that was story after story, day after day with Corey Lewandowski, till he became a distraction of sort, all right, with the campaign. Paul Manafort, the Russian story. I don't know how one gets around this. Now, I don't think it's had the attention, because the headline by CNN was Trump supporter turns Anthony in or something like that. No, it's Anthony Weiner has done something that if one of your listeners did, which was to sext with their shirt off in a very uncomfortable picture that I won't go any further with a child next to them, Children's Services would have been knocking on your listeners' doors this morning. I mean, this morning, Mike. Mm-hmm. So I think it has an impact if Huma Aberdeen stays, because, you know, where is Anthony Weiner's judgment? By the way, I serve with him. I know him well. But where is his judgment? And if has she been relating private information to Anthony Weiner? Where's his judgment? Did he sext that information out also? I mean, so it just questions the whole Clinton judgment, the whole ball of wax. Now, I don't think it's a silver spike. But with the dripping and dripping and dripping of the Clinton Foundation emails, I think they have a overall problem that kind of integrates together. They definitely all have a problem, including Trump, with Twitters and emails, don't they?
Yeah, and one of the things that's interesting is that Huma is also at the center of this State Department Clinton Foundation controversy over how close of a connection are the two.
Oh, she's at the center of it. Having been through these types of things myself, if right now a special prosecutor or a prosecutor would sit Huma down and about five or six employees that worked for her, I promise you they would go into a major panic, because I've had it happen with my staff and myself. And one thing leads to another thing, which is not good. That's not going to happen. So, but the public perception, and I have a relative of mine who would crawl across glass for Hillary Clinton, and she tells me, this is nothing. And I tell her, you know what? Look, these emails are going to continue to drip out on the Clinton Foundation, and they're ugly. They are ugly emails. I think they're very damaging. Now, having said that, Donald Trump can't, you know, stop opening his mouth long enough to let some things soak in. So you know how that runs, too.
Yeah. Let me switch to Donald Trump, because over the weekend I noticed nobody was on the same page as they talked about, particularly immigration. All his surrogates were saying different things. Let's start there. Isn't that a problem for the campaign?
You know, it's funny you mentioned that, Mike, because it's the same thing. I was actually on a treadmill this weekend, and they have five different channels there, okay? So I'm surfing all these channels, because that tells you what my life's like on a Saturday. And I'm surfing all these channels, and I'm watching Huckabee and Kellyanne Conway with the Trump campaign. I'm watching all these people, and it was like watching five different universes. And nobody knew what to say. And so Donald Trump has a real pivotal problem here, and that is, he's trying to appear, you know, a bit softer for people who are even Republicans saying, ooh, doesn't he just go too far with this stuff? So he's trying to bring some people in. He's not going to expect to get a ton of African-American votes, although I will tell you, he has caused Clinton to react, has he not? So I know that, you know, even if he takes 5% more of the African-American vote, it's going to be a tight election, so that's a lot. But having said that, he has to also watch about his base. Does he lose his base?
Mm-hmm. And that's what I want to turn to, Bob. He's got a big immigration speech tomorrow. He is all over the map, it seems, on immigration. He talks with Hannity, and it seems like there's a pathway to citizenship. You know, there's not going to deport 11 million. Goes on CNN, says something different. What does he need to do to quell this storm? Because I got to believe some of his rock-solid supporters are saying, what is going on?
Well, I was sitting there thinking about how Trump started in the wall, and also the fact that, you know, just 2 days ago, an illegal person, which one of the news networks called them undocumented, instead of illegal, but an illegal person drove a bus into this group of people on a bus that were going to help the flood victims, and two fire chiefs died. And I'm looking at that, and it's like, okay, you know, there are criminal elements to illegals that have come here. Not all of them, but there are criminal elements. And then all of a sudden, you see where Trump's maybe going to change his position on that? I mean, it makes me think, where's he going? And what about the wall? How do you get out of now not building a wall? So I think he's got to be very, very careful that he doesn't alienate a base out there. I think he's got to be careful. I'm fascinated to see how he's going to maneuver through this one, tap dance around it.
But he creamed Bush and Rubio and Kasich,
sure,
on the fact that they said you can't deport 11 million people, and yet he's now saying that.
And he may still want to do something with the 11 million, but I think he realizes it would take the entire 50-state Army National Guard to start going door to door. You know, and there's ways that you can do it, because the Bush administration, when the illegals were caught, and I have a personal situation of dealing with this, they crossed a picket line, and they were caught, and I called immigration. Immigration said, no, they didn't violate the law, let them go. Bush was president, let them go. Well, cases like that, if you catch them, then you do deport them. Mm-hmm. If you round up 20 people in a truck in Wheeling, West Virginia, that happened also, by the way. I witnessed that through the sheriff down there. And the immigration said, let him go. Now, that can be dealt with. So I don't know if he's going to nuance it that way, you know, that when you catch them, they don't have to be charged with an additional crime, which even the Bush administration said, well, they aren't charged with additional crime, we let them stay. So maybe he'll nuance it that way. I don't know. how he's going to deal with this.
It's going to be an interesting time because he won the this. It was the centerpiece of of his campaign, which is illegal immigration. And most people don't his supporters. I didn't say most people, but his supporters are with him because of this issue.
Well, there's another issue here too. Look, the president is bringing in October the last of the 10,000 original committed to Syrian refugees, right?
Mm-hmm.
Hillary Clinton, without a doubt, wants to bring 500% more. That's a fact. Having said that, does Donald Trump change his whole ban them from bad countries theme? And then, you know, somebody does some type of violent act that comes in amongst the refugees, and all of a sudden, Trump's no different than Hillary Clinton. You know, I mean, there he's taken a step off the diving board a year ago, and I mean, he can land in half of the swimming pool filled up, but he can't land in an empty pool.
Well, speaking of the election, I'm curious on your take on this. You know, normally in an election, the issues of the economy and foreign policy are at the forefront. And what you see so far is this debate where it's delved into Hillary Clinton calling Donald Trump a racist and Donald Trump saying she's a bigot. And we're talking about sexting. We're talking about all sorts of things. But we're not talking about the economy and foreign policy. Why?
Well, right now, we have one of the most unbalanced budgets, well, the most unbalanced budget in the nation's history. I was there in 1998 when we had the first balanced budget in a generation. And we have this. And to me, it is number one, personally, above all other issues, because our young, my great-great-grandchildren are going to be strapped with this thing, which is ridiculous, personally, I'm speaking here, okay? Now, having said that, what did we see this week? Nothing about ISIS, nothing about the budget, nothing about the thousands that are going to be thrown off of Obamacare as we speak, one-third of the country's counties. We are trying to determine who's going to die first, Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump. Which one has a terminal disease we don't know about? You know what I'm saying? The last 3 days is all health care and their doctors. And Uma and her husband and, you know, Bannon that beat his wife 20 years ago that works for Trump. I mean, this is all that we've seen. And I don't know how it ever... I mean, those things are all issues. I understand that, Mike, but you raise a great point. I mean, how do we really get back to what we care about? And then the election ends, and people say, well, what about all that stuff?
Yeah, and so my question is, why doesn't Trump bring it up? He seems to be distracted on these little things like... And let's face it, the news loves these little things, but it doesn't get to the big issues that this country is facing.
He has an opportunity because these debates, I think, and I have said this on your show, I've said this with you for weeks and weeks and weeks, this is going to be a close election. Anybody that thinks, you know, these polls are going to narrow and this Clinton stuff's going to drip out and then Donald Trump's going to make mistakes, I think the debate is a significant time for somebody to bring a brand new series of subjects into this thing, I think.
Would that be your advice to the Trump campaign if they were asking you for your advice in the debates?
If I was asked for advice, I'll tell you, for Trump, I've got some for Clinton, but for Trump, I would tell Donald Trump to make fun of himself. Mm-hmm. I would. I would tell him at some point in time that, you know, that he is not all right. And that he, you know, I would do some type of self-depreciating humor, like, you know, Bill Clinton used to do, like George Bush used to do, you know, spelling nuclear. I would do something to take away that narcissistic, I know it all, I'm great deal. I really would. I would do something. It doesn't have to, you know, make horrible fun of himself, but he's got to do something. I would make himself more human. And then the other thing I would tell him is, you know, he can get pointed at her because she deserves some things. But then again, my advice to him would be bring this back to what, you know, what your listeners, Mike, thought about this morning as they were fixing kids' breakfast and trying to work a job each and who picks the kids up and how do we pay for their school when they got a child going to college. That whole treadmill everybody's on every single day out there in America, he could bring it home to them. That's what I'd tell him. What would you say?
What would you say in the unlikely situation that the Clinton campaign would give you a call and ask for advice?
Number one, I don't know how you do this, but they've got to soften the and I know Trump yells, but I, forget him for a second. They've got to soften that. I mean, and also get off of Barack Obama and Bill Clinton and everybody else she likes to drag in, how much everybody loves her and all the endorsements. And if she wants to be breaking the glass ceiling, then stand there on her own and talk about what she's about. And also, if I were her, I no matter what, I wouldn't buy. I would have her defend herself, but don't let Donald Trump taunt her down a path where she loses it, even semi loses it. You know.
Lastly, let's turn to sports for a minute. Colin Kaepernick's decision not to stand. He's a 49ers quarterback. Some question whether he'll be the starting quarterback of the 49ers. This was even before the controversy. But Colin Kaepernick's decision not to stand during the national anthem, what's your take?
Well, it's a free country. He can do what he pleases. But I have friends, you know, and he was raised, I won't say in privilege like the 1%. He was raised in a pretty darn good family, had a lot of opportunity, makes a lot of money. And I don't know how he personally has been just stepped all over by this society. Having said that, if he really stands up for people and wants to do that, cough up some of that $100 million and give it to whoever, NAACP or some civil rights group or something, do that. There's ways to speak out. I think it was stupid of how he chose to do it. And I have friends of mine who are African-American who have been wronged, absolutely wronged in modern-day society. And you know what? They know, though, people went to a civil war to fight to undo that horrible injustice done with slavery. So, I can find 10 reasons not to stand up today that are making me mad. And I don't get this one. I think it was more about him than it is about everything else under the sun. I think he picked the wrong way, personally.
Bob, as always, it's been a pleasure checking in with you, and we'll check in again with you tomorrow.
Absolutely.
Bob Ney, Talk Media News. Coming up, Don Rendell, President and CEO of Vermont Gas. We're going to be talking about the Vermont Gas Pipeline expansion and the rate case that's currently going on with Vermont Gas. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. So let's turn our attention now to Vermont Gas, the Vermont Gas Pipeline expansion and rate case. And in the studio with me in our WDEV studios is Don Rendell, President and CEO of Vermont Gas. First of all, Don, good morning and thank you for being here.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Why is there's two main subjects I want to discuss this morning. One is the actual pipeline expansion, and we'll talk about that first, but also is the pending rate case that's going on with Vermont Gas, because I think it is a little bit confusing, and I want to make sure that people understand what is going on. And we tried to delve into it a little bit with Chris Recchia this morning and the two sides to this rate case. But first, the pipeline expansion. Why is the pipeline expansion necessary?
So let's talk about the pipeline expansion just for a minute and put it in context. The pipeline expansion was proposed in 2011, about 5 years ago, and today we're right on the cusp of finishing it up. You know, it's a 41-mile project from Colchester to Middlebury. We've got about 250 people out in the field working today. We'll have it wrapped up in about 1 month. Most of the pipe is out there. The right of way is prepared. We've got a lot of it 100% complete, and we're in the final stage of completing it. We have one piece of the puzzle left to deal with in getting access for construction in Hinesburg. And when we get that piece of the puzzle solved, we'll be able to finish it up and serve thousands of families and businesses in Addison County who've been waiting patiently for having the choice of natural gas service to have us there and available so that they can make the choice between oil propane, sometimes kerosene, and natural gas.
And is that the reason for the pipeline is the choice?
The reason for the pipeline is the choice. The reason is our commitment to bringing choice and opportunity, energy choice and opportunity, to Vermont families and businesses. You know, the company's been in existence since 1965. We just celebrated our 50th year anniversary. We've got 50,000 customers in Franklin and Chittenden counties that have enjoyed natural gas service for 50 years. Some of them, as we have grown into new communities over the past several years, those customers are saving, gosh, last year they saved almost $18 million compared to oil and propane by using natural gas. The offset of natural gas compared to oil and propane, and in conjunction with the award-winning energy efficiency programs that we provide, offset carbon to at a level of almost 10% of the cars and trucks on the road in Vermont. Those are tremendous benefits for the families and businesses in Chittenden and Franklin counties, and this expansion project is our effort to bring those benefits, those opportunities, that choice to the families and businesses in Addison County.
Let's go back to Hinesburg, because you said that there is a sort of, I won't call it a delay, but there is sort of a hiccup in Hinesburg. What is the issue in Hinesburg?
Well, we have a piece of property. Let's put it in context. So the entire 41 miles involved 164 landowners. And we have agreements with all 164 of them, including the town of Hinesburg. There is a park in Hinesburg. It's called Japrags Park, and we are proposing to drill underneath that park, to put a pipeline underneath that park, 30 to 50 feet below the park, which will get us across that piece of land to connect the dots and get the pipeline connected and ready to go here. That parcel is still in a technical eminent domain process at the Public Service Board because of its nature as a park, and we're hoping to get that resolved soon. And as I said, connect the dots and get this project done and serve our new customers in Addison County.
So the Public Service Board has the power to decide on eminent domain cases in this instance.
Yes, they do. They have the power, and we've asked them to do that to make clear that the easement that we will need to build the pipeline will be solid and lawful.
A lawyer is contending that your approval process for the pipeline is invalid because you went through the PBS process, the Public Service Board process, rather than the Act 250 process. I imagine you disagree with that.
Yes, we do. This is a transmission line project, and as such, it is under the jurisdiction and the approval authority of the Vermont Public Service Board. That's where we presented it 5 years ago, and we have proceeded through that process now, not once, but three times, as we have gone through the cycle of review of this project, which has undergone more scrutiny than any utility project, certainly in my 20-plus years of experience in the utility field.
We're speaking with Don Rendell, who is the president and CEO of Vermont Gas. If you wish to join our conversation, if you have a comment, a concern, a question, give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. We're talking about Vermont Gas pipeline expansion down through to Addison County. And in a moment, we'll turn to a rate case that is I guess in dispute, but let's talk about that in a minute. There are delays as a result of, you know, we talked about the delays that are in order to make sure. Let's wait to the rate case, because what's going to happen is I'm going to talk about delays in the rate case and how that affects the rate case. But one of the things that was a surprise to many people is that, and I talked to Chris Recchia about this, but the protest costs being picked up by the ratepayer Obviously, you signed an MOU with the department that had that provision in there. Why did you sign it?
Well, we agreed to a cost cap that would protect customers, a cost cap of $134 million. And that was an important agreement that we achieved with the Department of Public Service a year ago. It was approved by the Public Service Board, and it provides a really significant protection to customers for a project that is going to cost substantially more than that. What does that mean in real life? That means that the company has agreed not to impose any costs over $134 million on customers. It's the company's responsibility. It's the shareholders' responsibility for those excess costs, and that's a big number, right? I mean, at the current budget, that's about $31 million. It's a huge number. We've agreed to do that. The memorandum of understanding did have some provisions in it about cost items that would not be within the company's control. One of those was unreasonable interference with construction. Not protests, unreasonable interference with construction. And allowed us to set those costs aside and talk about them another day. And that is what we agreed to do.
Let's talk about the MOU for a minute. It obviously has what I would call a cap at $134 million that ratepayers are responsible for. Anything above and beyond that cap is what are the responsibilities of shareholders. And I think the project cost right now is estimated about $161 million. Am I right on that?
$165.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I'm having problems discerning here is, isn't it all ratepayers' money that comes into this, whether it's a profit that ultimately goes to shareholders or there's dividends that ultimately go to shareholders? Isn't the money that's coming in, isn't the revenue that's coming in actually from ratepayers? And what's the difference between ratepayers and shareholders is what?
Well, sure. So the shareholder, the company, pays for the project. We make the investment in the project. That's money at risk, just as if you were investing in a new house or a new car. And our revenue source is the service that we provide to customers and what customers pay us for providing that service. And that revenue then is what we use to operate the business, which includes covering the cost of borrowing and the cost of investment for a project like this. That's true up to $134 million, but with the cap, what that means in real life is that when the customer's prices are set, the everything over $134 is washed off the page. It's not part of our pricing, and ultimately it's written off.
We're talking with Don Rendell, who is the president and CEO of Vermont Gas. If you wish to join our conversation, the number is 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Let's go to Bob in Plainfield. Bob, good morning.
Good morning. Just wondering if your guest had any regrets or second thoughts via eminent domain of taking people's property just so his outfit can make money.
There you go, Don.
Well, thank you for the question, Bob. When I talked about
thanks, Bob.
When I talked about 164 landowners, we were able to achieve agreements with all 164 without the necessity of any eminent domains, and we did not have to go through the eminent domain process with any of those landowners. We have one eminent domain pending, and that is with the town of Hinesburg, and it's not about the value or the. It's about the nature of the way that the town owns that property, and it's a way to clear the land title on that property to allow the project to proceed.
One of the things that has been infamous about this project are the price changes that have happened in the cost estimates that have changed in this project. What happened?
Well, you know, the project has been a big challenge. It's been a big challenge from the beginning, and the history of the project is that it was estimated low at the beginning. When I arrived in December of 2014, almost 2 years ago, we took a hard look at the project because the costs had the cost estimates were increasing, and we said, we've got to reset this thing. We've got to see what this project is going to cost in real life, given all of the challenges, whether they be the topographical challenges, you know, the challenges in the field, whether they be the challenges around the scrutiny and the regulation, whether they be the challenges of 164 landowners and our commitment not to use eminent domain except as a last resort, whether they be the challenges of having contractors who are able to get the job done in an efficient way. And we reset the project at that time at 154. We worked incredibly hard to stay on track there, and we have experienced in the field as we've done the construction. We've experienced some changes that have upped that about 8% to the $165 million number. You know, nothing that I'm particularly excited about. I mean, these have been tough calls for us, and we have done a really intensive job of doing our best to manage those costs, to making sure we've got great people in the field, and to getting the project done effectively, efficiently, and in a way that is respectful of all of the landowners along the corridor. And that's where we are.
One of the things in infrastructure projects, you always expect overruns. But this is double the cost in terms of overrun. Is there something you could have done different in the beginning to keep these overruns from happening?
Well, you know, it's hard for me to speak to what was going on in 2011 when the teams first estimated the cost. What I can tell you is that yes, there are things you can do, and we did that in the winter of 2014-15. We stepped back, we took a hard look, and we reset the project, and we've worked really hard to manage in that range, and yes, we have had some additional challenges. We've been very open and direct in reporting what they are. We've been very open and direct in bringing people along on the progress we've been making, and I'm proud of the work that our team is doing to finish it up. We're really close.
Protesters and opponents of this project will claim that the pipeline really isn't needed. It increases our carbon footprint. It is fossil fuel. And it comes from fracking. Also, AARP says that it will drive up the cost of ratepayers. How do you respond to all those?
Well, that's quite a list. let's talk first about bringing choice to Addison County. Whether this pipeline is needed or not is really in the hands of the families and businesses in Addison County that are waiting for it. This is a choice, not a mandate. And you know, we've brought this choice to many communities over the past several years, to Jericho, to Underhill, to Hinesburg, and to Enosburg. And what we found is that families and businesses they appreciate the choice, and they're choosing us. We've had very strong response from prospective customers in those communities because they save money and because they reduce their carbon footprint. This every family or business that converts from oil to natural gas makes a substantial reduction in their carbon footprint. This decreases our carbon footprint. It doesn't increase our carbon footprint.
But it still relies on fossil fuel. What the protesters will say, let's go to renewable energy instead of a fossil fuel-based fuel.
Sure, and we're making great progress as a state, as a country, as a planet in moving toward renewable energy in all aspects of our how we use energy, and we'll continue to do that. And we look forward to being part of that commitment. This is a way to make a big step forward in reducing our carbon footprint. Natural gas has been one of the key reasons why our country has reduced its carbon footprint relative to what it otherwise would be, as we have increased our use of natural gas across the country, and that's certainly true in Vermont, where, as I said, you know, if we didn't have this natural gas infrastructure in Chittenden and Franklin County, counties, we would be we would have a much larger carbon footprint, equivalent to 10% of our vehicle use in the state.
Let's also address AARP's concern that says this is a will drive up cost of other ratepayers.
Well, let's put that in context as well. Our cost to customers, our prices, our rates have decreased since 2012 by 15%, and we're here in a rate case, which you
my next question,
which you've asked to discuss, where we're asking for a rate decrease. Vermont Gas, February, asked for a 3.3% rate decrease for next year. The Department of Public Service, who is our regulator, has recently made their recommendation, which is also for a rate decrease. It's a little bit bigger than ours, and we'll go through the process and welcome the opportunity to have the debate about what the right number is. But gosh, we're all looking at how customer costs are going to go down next year, not up.
I want to look at the issue of rates in just a moment. We'll take a short break, come back, and discuss rates. The one question I just wanted to ask before we do this, it's still on the pipeline expansion. How did the sunflowers get mowed down when there seemed to be agreement that you weren't going to mow them down?
Well, great question, and they shouldn't have been mowed down. We went to great lengths to protect those sunflowers, and we were responsible to do so. We had our contractor crew was out there to do the work to protect the sunflowers. They got out a little bit ahead of themselves. There was a contractor out there, and he mowed down some of those sunflowers. He didn't realize what he was doing. He did it. It was unacceptable. We stepped up to the plate. We self-reported immediately. We shut down that work. We worked with our regulators, with the Agency of Natural Resources, and we got it back on track. We'll still have some more work to do there with ANR, and we'll continue to cooperate with them. But certainly something that we've been very focused on, because we are determined to do the right thing every day as we finish up this project.
We're speaking with Don Rendell, who is the president and CEO of Vermont Gas. If you wish to join our conversation, the number is 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. When we come back, I do want to change to the actual rate case and talk about that in a moment in the remaining time that we have. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. We're speaking with Don Rendell, President and CEO of Vermont Gas. If you wish to join our conversation, the number is 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. Let's go to the phone lines and Jane in Moncton. Jane, you're on Open Mic.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. My question for Mr. Rendell is regarding this pipeline. He keeps saying this is to provide choice for people in Addison County. So is that the purpose of this pipeline? Is this purpose to serve Addison County, or is it something else? Is it, that's what we've been hearing, is that it's kind of a large pipe that maybe it's going to end up being a thoroughfare, and the fact that it's only going to hook up, you know, a couple of thousand people at best case scenario, and it seems very expensive for this. So my question is, why is this such an expensive proposition to get to Addison County, and what's the real purpose of this pipe?
Thanks, Jane, for the question. Don?
Thank you, Jane, for the question. Yes, this pipeline is designed to serve Addison County, to serve Middlebury, to serve Virgins, to serve Bristol, to serve some folks in Moncton. That's what it's intended to do, and that's what it will do when we're completed. We don't have any plans to do anything else. Like all of our system, the pipeline is designed so that we do have the opportunity if conditions are appropriate, if Vermonters want us to do it, to be able to continue to bring choice and opportunity to new communities in the future. But this one is aimed at Addison County. That's what we asked to be permitted, and that's what it's there for.
The original plan had been Addison County and Rutland County with going over to Ticonderoga. Ticonderoga has gone with a different method already. The plant over there has gone with a different method of fueling their needs. Is there still plans to go to Rutland County?
Well, yes, we dropped the project to go to Ticonderoga, and this pipeline would have been able to serve that need if that project had gone forward. But we canceled that project in early 2015. We have talked a lot over the past few years about bringing natural gas service to Rutland. You know what I've been saying, and what I say here is, Our focus is getting this project done. This has been plenty challenging for us, and if we're going to go beyond this beyond Middlebury in the future, we're going to have to do it in a different way. And we will be there at the table with those who want to see how we can bring choice and opportunity to new communities, to Rutland County, and look forward to having those discussions. We're not going to do it this way, where we have this much contention and this much divisiveness over this kind of infrastructure.
Let's turn to the rate case for a moment. What you have proposed is, there's a lot of numbers flying around here. There's the 3.3%, which is a reduction in rates of 3.3%. There is the department that claims, if you do apples to apples, it's actually 2-something%. And then their request is to reduce the rates 5.68% or thereabouts. What's confusing to me is, how do you come up with the rate?
So the rate making is it's an interesting process. I often refer to it as, if you're kind of going through it and looking at it from the outside without being deeply involved in it, as reading every other page of a book. Our rates are decreasing. We have asked for a decrease, and our residential and small commercial customers, the ask that we made was 3.3% down. The department has asked for a slightly bigger one. What goes into that, the arithmetic that achieves those outcomes is the cost of doing the business, is the cost of providing safe, reliable, high value service to customers. What are those costs? What are those costs? What are those operational costs? What are those capital costs? And you stack them up, you build them from the ground up, and that's what determines what what we present and ultimately what the regulator presents as well, to determine what is a just and reasonable price for the service that we provide.
And Don, how is this resolved? You have two different numbers out there. How is it ultimately resolved?
So we've got two different numbers out there. We'll have a chance to make our response to the department's presentation. We've got some disagreements there. We'll have some hearings in front of the Public Service Board in the winter, and ultimately the Public Service Board will make their decision early next year.
If you could go back and change anything, what would you change in this process or construction?
Are we talking the what?
The pipeline.
Oh, the pipeline. Well, you know, I think we've done a really good job of dealing with the challenges that we've had when they have presented themselves, and making good decisions. Second guessing is always easy. It's especially easy if you if you haven't had to make the decisions in the first place. I'm very proud of the decisions that we've made over the last 18 months as we've tackled this project, as we've kept our focus on getting it done as efficiently and as safely as we can. I don't have any regrets about the decisions that we've made.
What have you learned through the process?
Well, this has been one of the great things about this job, and one of the things about any really good job is that you it's a learning experience every day. I'll tell you one thing that I have learned, and that is that when you look at projects like this at the very front end, when you're planning them, is that it's so important to have the right folks doing the work. That's very important to have a very clear-eyed view of what the challenges will be, what the risks will be, and what the opportunities are, and to do a really good job at the front end to understand the real world consequences and the real world challenges of infrastructure projects of this complexity.
Don Rendell, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
That's Don Rendell, President and CEO of Vermont Gas. One of the things I wanted to do is try to slip in here really quickly. Tom, if you can give me a time check, I would appreciate it. Sad news this morning when we all learned that actor Gene Wilder has died, the actor known as Willy Wonka, the Waco Kid, and Dr. Frankenstein in many movies that we've talked about. For example, the 1971 Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, the 1974 Young Frankenstein movie, the 1967 The Producer, or the 1974, which is my favorite, Blazing Saddles, is certainly some of the memories of Gene Wilder. Plus, he teamed up with Richard Pryor in movies in the 80s and his third wife, Gilda Radner. So Gilda Radner died, of course, of cancer in 1989, and if we would had time today, I would have asked you to call in and talk about your favorite Gene Wilder movie, A Gentle, Gentle Person, as it seems. We don't ever know these people, but it is with sadness that we learn that he died and that he had dementia or Alzheimer's and died from that horrible, horrible disease. I want to thank our guest, Chris Recchia, Commissioner of Public Service Department, Bob Ney from Talk Media News, and Don Rendell, President and CEO of Vermont Gas, and of course, all of you. This is Open Mic, and you are listening to locally owned and operated WDEV News Radio on the Friendly Pioneer, celebrating its 85th year anniversary this year. That's what I said, 85 years, celebrating the future in this anniversary year. WDEV AM 550 broadcasting from Waterbury and Montpelier, 96.1 from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barrie, and serving the kingdom at 101.9 FM from Isle and Pond. Of course, we're streaming worldwide at WDEVradio.com. I'm Mike Smith. Thank you for all your phone calls. Have a great rest of your day, and we'll talk again tomorrow.
The Open Mic Podcast is brought to you by Hickok Boardman, Dennis Ricker and Brown.
Find us online at hbinsurance.com. And you're always welcome to visit us on Facebook, in Vermont, online, on the phone. Hickok and Boardman Insurance Group. We are here when you need us.